It's nice. It's nice in here. Yeah, we're all set. We got people coming in the door. I'm just going to give them a chance to get seated. Okay, welcome to the last group of our afternoon session. I'm Sue Stinson from the Balfour Audio Archive at Syracuse University. And this afternoon, our first presenters we welcome are Mary Ellen Ducey and Pete Brink. Mary Ellen Ducey serves as the University Archivist, Special Collections Librarian at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Libraries. She obtained a Master's in Library Science from Indiana University and a Master's in History from the University of South Dakota. She supervises the Botkin Preservation Microfilming Project, which is supported by a grant from NEH. And along with her colleagues at the UNL Archives, she has become familiar with Ben Botkin's illegible scrawl, his tendency to keep everything, and through this current presentation, his New York accent. Peterson Brink is the Archives Associate at the University of Nebraska Archives and Special Collections. He received a master's degree in Museum Studies from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Before this position with the University of Nebraska, he worked at the Nebraska State Historical Society's Gerald R. Ford Conservation Center and the Museum of Nebraska History. So, without further ado, we welcome Mary Ellen and Pete.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just going to say a few things before we get started that Pete and I are really happy to be here. We had a really pleasant experience so far and hope to continue that this afternoon with our talk. We have a lot of quotes from the materials that we use, and so we're going to not go through a whole lot of quotes and end quotes just to save you from that. And to just let you know that as we started with this project, we really just we scratched the surface. So we're going to talk very generally about several things, and have a lot to go through for after this part of our work on this project. Can everybody hear okay? Okay, good. I don't want to pop too many peas. Mm-hmm. Get up to the top. And okay, the bad men and the culture of the American West brought folklorist Benjamin A. Botkin together with several eminent authorities who combined their talents and created a spoken word and music tribute to the mythology of the bad men. His experiences provided him with an opportunity to meet a wide variety of people who were interested in the preservation and study of folklore, of music, and of literary works. With colleagues who studied the American West or participated in its history, Botkin assisted in the creation of a spectacular musical historical project. Columbia Records published The Bad Men in 1963 as part of the Columbia Records Legacy Collection. The two-album box set was noted as a splendid fusion of folk art, graphics, social history, and the recording crafts. In 1963, for the 6th Grammy Awards, The Bad Men was nominated for 2 Grammys, one as Best Documentary, Spoken Word, or Drama Recording Other Than Comedy, and Best Album Notes. According to Botkin, The Bad Men recording presented to the listener, quote, "the story of the bad men, the story of the frontier, not one West, but many Wests. The frontier West, the West of the fur trader and trapper, the West of the miner, the West of the cattleman and the cowboy, and the West of the settler, the West of the homesteader and the pioneer farmer." Botkin tried to make sure he could include absolutely everything. In the Botkin collection of applied American folklore at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln are hundreds and hundreds of reel-to-reel tapes. Transferred to digital media through the work of the Mars Sound Archive and through the support of the UNL Library Administration, these recordings provide more than the materials that made the final cut for the Bad Men album. Hundreds of hours of tape were narrowed down to just a few minutes on the actual album, and in our presentation today, we've narrowed that down even further and have been able to highlight a few things that didn't appear on the record and to show a bit of what people could read in the liner notes and articles. According to music reviewer O.M. Brummel, the Bad Men album, quote, mounted a brilliant, indeed an awesome, counterattack on the gunmen and their silly legends. In a superb marriage of song and story, pictures and text, this two-record album provides a haunting glimpse of the American past. This is history unfolded in the most graphic form. Brummel noted that the album succeeded in supporting the success of true legends over the standard fables that permeated cultural consciousness. Okay, here we go. Benjamin Botkin was a preeminent and pioneering folklorist. He wrote, edited, and gathered together over 800 boxes of materials for his studies of popular America through folklore. His work represented the evolving nature of folklore and did not separate the lore from the folk who created it. He saw the study and use of American folklore as contributing to creative writing and understanding of history and cultural renewal. Botkin's work resulted in over a dozen popular compilations of folklore treasuries. Among them are the Treasury of American Folklore, the Treasury of Western Folklore, and a Civil War treasury, just to name a few. Goddard Lieberson was president of Columbia Records at the time this project was done. He supported the documentation of American music and viewed the Mad Men recording as an instrument of culture. Lieberman explained that the objective behind the Mad Men was to give an oral and visual panorama of the myths and the truth behind the myths of this aspect of our history, this aspect of our American folk art. He believed that this was part of the American past that has so far never lost its fascination for a large segment of the American public. Sylvester Vigilante served as editorial consultant on the project with Botkin. A bibliographer at the New York Public Library, Vigilante's knowledge of the American West was exemplified through the collection of the American History Room of the New York Public Library. According to the notes on the contributors, his knowledge of the Western outlaws and lawmen is so ingrained in his character that he gives the impression of having known them personally and seen them clear. James D. Horan, a journalist, also produced numerous books on the American West and Western bad men such as Jesse James. He interviewed George Boldes, a legend of Dodge City, Kansas, and also wrote a biography of Boldes called Across the Cimarron, Marshal George Boldes' Own Story of His Life and Adventures in the Cowtowns of the Wild West. Harold Priest, born and raised in Texas, claimed to be related to Sam Bass. He started his writing career as a journalist but went on to publish books on the Dalton Gang, the Texas Ranger Ira Ayton, and Pioneers of the American West. And if I mispronounce anything, just holler. These scholars of folklore in the West combined their talents with musicians who could exemplify the spirit of folklore and stories told through music and through songs meant to tell the story men and women who developed their own systems of right and wrong. They produced a recording that included both music and spoken word. The music side of the album includes 16 songs produced by Jack Elliott, Carolyn Hester, Harry Jackson, Ed McCurdy, Jax Menahem, and Pete Seeger. Charlie Bird and Sandy Bull provided guitar and banjo accompaniment. Again, O.B. Brummel, a reviewer, wrote, "The songs are vital and often moving. They are a sobering lesson in the evolution of folklore, for few of them relate in any way to reality. The songs illustrated the romanticism and mythology surrounding folk heroes, and in addition, prove the value of folk song as a vehicle for cultural history." Botkin's writing career exemplifies the importance of folk song to folklore, the similarities of their development, and the constant change surrounding both. Like folklore, folk songs were an oral tradition handed down down to generations with no existence fixed by print. They have no standard form but are continually changing. Louise Pound, Botkin's mentor at the University of Nebraska, said that folk songs are characterized by the fact that they have retained their vitality through a fair period of time and that all sense of their authorship and provenance has been lost by their singers. And if our clips are going to work, okay, oops, sorry. Vigilante and Botkin discussed this same issue when they were searching for various authors of Bad Men ballads.
But it says that this song was made by Billy Gaffney.
Where's the volume?
Awesome.
This needs to hear. Turn it down.
We'll try it one more time just to see if. Okay, well, I'll just go on and go ahead. The spoken word sides of the album provided a definition of the bad men and placed them within the history of the American West through a unique opportunity to interview those who witnessed the lives of notorious Western outlaws and those whose lives were affected by them. A 1963 New York Times review noted that the spoken words are rich in regional vernacular, have all the excitement of a tale told at granddad's or grandmom's knee. Folklorist and close colleague of Botkin's, Bruce Jackson, noted in Listen, a Music Monthly, it is a constant surprise to realize, as one does while listening to these voices, how close that foreign world of the wild frontier really is. Okay, you ready to swap? Okay.
In the track, the lawman's wife, Zoe Tillman, the wife of Kansas and Oklahoma law officer Bill Tillman, reminisced about the law career of her husband. Zoe was interviewed by Phil Nolan March 15, 1961 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. She remembered that Tillman was quick, could shoot with both hands, knew when he was in danger, and knew how to take risks. Quote, Bill had the supreme confidence in himself, and he could watch the other fella, and he knew he could tell some way, and he was so utterly quick himself that he could draw and shoot before the other fella could come to it. End quote. Sophie Poe's husband, Deputy Sheriff John Poe, rode with Pat Garrett. From an interview, am I changing the slides here? There we go. From an interview done in 1950 by Fred Mazzulla and W.T. Moyers came the album cut titled They Can't Make a Hero Out of Him. Sophie recounted the killing of Billy the Kid by Pat Garrett and her husband. She noted that her husband went along with Garrett and was there when Garrett shot the outlaw. As for Billy the Kid, Poe stated, you know, he was 21 years old and he had killed 22 men, and they can't make a hero out of that man. Homer Croy spoke about the James boys and their careers in Missouri in The Case for Jesse James. The Jameses were Croy's neighbors, and he remembered that the James boys fought in the Civil War for the South with another bad man, William Quantrill. He confirmed that Jesse lived by the honor code of the bad man, explaining that, well, Jesse had his faults, but doggone it, he had his virtues too. He wouldn't cheat at a pool game, and he wouldn't steal from a friend. A code of honor permeates the legends of the bad man. In the cut, Training of a Westerner, George Bowles described... Did I skip a page there? George Bowles describes his trip out west and how he convinced his parents to let him leave home only after they had enough money saved to bring him back. For Horan and Vigilante, George Bowles was one of the last living links with the American West. Get back there. Is that clipping that there? Sorry about that. So we just need to go on this one. In 1953, at age 89, Bowles recounted his adventures with lawmen such as Bat Masterson, Wyatt Earp, and Bill Tillman. In his interview, Bowles tells how it came about that he was on a train to Dodge City in 1880, and I'll see if this, hopefully this one works. Is that not playing at all? Here we go.
Oh, there he is. Biggest town in the West. The fellow reached up and pulled down a ticket.
Let's start that one again. Okay.
Well, I guess we can't. I didn't know where the hell it was, you know, but I looked at it, and it was a first-class ticket from Kansas City to Dodge City, Kansas.
Let me start that clip again. Here.
He says to the fellow, he says, here's a kid, he says, wants to go to the toughest, biggest town in the West. The fellow reached up and pulled down a ticket and stamped it and handed it to me. He says, $8, please. I didn't know where the hell it was, you know, but I looked at it, and it was a first-class ticket from Kansas City to Dodge City, Kansas. I stood there, and the fellow said, come on, he said, there's a train out here, I'm going to put you on the train. I said, oh, no, I said, I can find it. And he went with me, he said, I want to see you to get on the train. He says, you're going to Dodge City. He says, you want to be careful out there. I had a brother out there a while back, and he came home. I said, didn't he like it out there? He says, yes, they shipped him home in a box.
In Dodge City, Bat Masterson took a look at Bolds' clothes, and he pegged him as a greenhorn, so he set him up with a new gun and told him to practice shooting until he could handle it. Within a few days, a horse thief found his way on his way out of town and stole that gun. So here's Bolds meeting Masterson, if I can get to it.
That kid just came in last night, he says, and we've got to look after him, he says. He means all right. He says, I know he ain't dressed like us people dressed out here, but he's all right. He's a nice boy. They went on laughing, you know, and Bat came up to me and said, I'm Bat Masterson.
Well, Bat Masterson was a deputy in Dodge City.
This is Sylvester Vigilante talking about this.
He was about 18, 20 years old at the time. And he was a very good police officer, too. He didn't do much killing. He became sheriff of Ford County for one term, and then was defeated after that. This young fellow was very fortunate, that his bold was, to fall in the hands of Bat Masterson.
In 1889, Bolds and Tillman were both at Cimarron, Kansas. Bolds was wounded when a mob fired upon lawmen seeking to transfer county records from Cimarron to Ingalls, Kansas. George Bolds helped to define the bad men, who they were, how people viewed them, and the characteristics that made the legends in the tumultuous West. Throughout all the stories and tall tales about Badman, certain characteristics are agreed upon. Botkin noted that the Badman as a good man, a good bad man and a bad good man met the requirements for both warrior and hero, which he listed as daring challenges, thrilling single combats, miraculous escapes, death through treachery, and possession of a favorite, often marvelous, magic gun or horse. The Western badmen, quote, were supposed to be kind, generous, handsome, happy, chivalrous, kind to women and children. They were supposed to be forced into a life of crime because of some outraged society dealt them off the bottom of the deck, end quote. Accordingly, honesty, decency, and reasonable obedience to law and order did not matter much in the making of a legend. Botkin noted that Americans, like other folk, choose or create heroes in their own image. Because of this tendency, he considered it inevitable that our heroes should embody, on the one hand, the primitive virtues of brute strength, courage, cunning, and on the other hand, the economic virtues of thrift, hard work, and perseverance. In the article titled Western Bad Man is Hero, printed in Mesquite and Willow, author Modi C. Boatwright lists several requirements for bad men. One, they must belong to the dominant Anglo-American majority. Two, they must come from a respectable but not wealthy family. Three, they must have an unfortunate childhood, a respectable but unfortunate family. Four, the first crimes are committed under extreme provocation. Five, as a hero, they must fight the enemies of the people, instruments of Yankee exploitation, the railroads, the express companies, and the banks. Six, they must perform acts of tenderness and generosity. Seven, they must atone for misdeeds, but can never attain redemption by turning informer against associates. And finally, some of the bad men live on for some. It's discovered some years later that a substitute has been buried, and the hero is now living an exemplary but obscure life. Vigilante confirms some of the honorific traits in this clip. If I can find my mouse. Get there. Damn it.
There was that very famous Butch Cassidy of the Wild Bunch. He was picked up, taken to jail in Wyoming. The day before he served jail, he asked if he couldn't go someplace. He wouldn't tell where, someplace, for 24 hours, and that he would be back. They let him go. He had confidence in Butch Cassidy, and there was an outlaw for you. And Butch Cassidy came back after 24 hours. Something about keeping your word there. That is why I think calling a man a liar out there was a terrible thing. Calling him a liar was a bad thing. It meant shooting. What is it that made the outlaw have a sort of a word of honor? I don't suppose they all did, but there were instances, the one he mentions, and this Butch Cassidy deal. When Butch Cassidy was finally released, he was pardoned after a few years, and he promised the governor of Wyoming that he would never rustle or hold up anything in the state of Wyoming. And when the governor of Utah heard about this, he said, boy, I wish he'd included us in his amnesty. Butch Cassidy kept his word. Oh, but he did go on rustling, but not there.
For the Badman Project, the contributors focused the stories of six bad men and one woman: William Quantrill, Jesse James, Frank James, Cole Younger, Sam Bass, Billy the Kid, Gregorio Cortez, and Bell Starr. Jesse James began his outlaw career robbing banks with Frank and Cole Younger. James is described as a great leader, but not a very skilled marksman. Homer Croy believed that Jesse had the qualities of a leader. Quote, 32 bandits under him, they were the toughest and most rugged characters, and if he didn't command them, then his life was in danger, end quote. He was also seen as a Western Robin Hood, who robbed banks and railroads, two entities that people had grudges against. The quandary is that these same people who were part of the posses created to search him out and kill him. In the end, a member of his own gang killed Jesse James for the reward money. And here is a clip about the myth of Jesse's. Oh, here, yeah, Botkin and Vigilante discussed Jesse's myth. Let me get there.
Why do you put in so many different songs? More of the
Jesse than the others?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a favorite dime novel hero.
Yes, you get the dime novels on Jesse James, but I don't think I saw more than a couple on Billy the Kid. I don't think I did, and they were very, very early. But the novels of Jesse James,
Legion.
Yes.
Basically, they're talking about the many novels of Jesse James and very few about Billy the Kid. Let's see. Sam Bass moved from Indiana to Texas in about 1870.
I have one kinsman whom I want to talk about.
This is Harold Priest, a Texan, talking about.
That old boy's name was Sam Bass. Sam was an outlaw, kind of a roundabout third or fourth cousin of mine, branch of my family that went from Kentucky to Indiana. Sam was kin to me through the Sheikses and the Martins. Back during the Reconstruction period, he landed with an uncle who was down in Mississippi. And from what they tell me, that uncle wanted more sweat out of a man than he wanted out of blood kinship. There was Sam, big old boy, about 18. Certainly, yeah, he could turn out a day's work, but that was before the day of electric saws. You had to saw wood back and forth. And the more you sawed, the more chips, the more sweat. Just wasn't any kind of a work for an ambitious lad like Sam.
Sam ends up doing some farming, and he bought a race pony, a little sorrel mare, also known as the Denton mare, that he raced to make money. He was hired as a cowboy for a cattle drive from Texas to Deadwood, South Dakota. But after the cattle were sold in Deadwood, he helped gamble away the profits from the sale.
'74 it was, he got tired of racing horses, so drifted up to the Northwest. He was around Dodge City, and he was around Deadwood. He drove a big trail herd of cattle up to Nebraska. And there in Deadwood, with another Texan named Joel Collins, who was the leader of the gang, he took to stage robbing. Well, shucks, he never was much at stagecoach robbing. His total take for about five or six months of it wasn't more than $30. Just about that time, the stagecoaches were beginning to give way to the railroads. Then and there, Sam and Joel Collins and the rest of the boys made the only big haul in recorded history. They robbed the UP train at Big Springs, Nebraska in September 1877. It was a right big haul, too. Maybe here was a boy who never had more than $60 in his pocket, suddenly shared $60,000. A mighty, mighty big cut. The officers got after them, and Joel Collins got dead. That was the windup of Joel. New Mexico officers, other officers ran Sam clear back to Texas. But fast money's always good money, and Sam had got it once, and he kind of figured he'd get it again.
After that, Bass returned to Denton, Texas, and became one of the most daring outlaws and train robbers of his time. And I think Botkin and Vigilante. Botkin and Vigilante discuss Sam Bass's... Well, let's talk about his death, actually. Sam... According to Harold Priest, Sam Bass kept his honor on his deathbed. And here's a clip about that.
Preacher Ayton goes in, looks at him, he says, "Mr. Bass came to help you. Is there anything I can do for you?" And according to one story I have, Sam Bass looked up at him and said, "Well, thanks, preacher. But it just kind of looks like that the devil's got me by the hind hooks. And there ain't much that you can do or say for us." And the Reverend Ayton said, "Well..." He said, "Well, Mr. Bass, if there's nothing I can do for you, you might as well go along." And then Sam Bass remembered his manners, because you don't talk back to a preacher in Texas. And he said that there were two things that he could say about himself: that he'd never stole a horse, which just ain't true, and that he'd never robbed a widder woman. Well, widder women didn't have much to rob in Texas. And that's the story that's come out of my family.
Soon after his death, relics of Sam Bass began to crop up in nearly every town in central and northern Texas. It's said that if all the authentic Bass guns could be gathered in one place, they could stock an arsenal. According to Botkin's drafts for the liner notes, the Superman among killers was Billy the Kid, whose golden legend has grown out of all proportion with the few sordid facts about his short, lightning-swift career. Born as William H. Bonney, by the age of 12, Billy had killed his first man for the crime of insulting his mother. Quote, "In his bland, quixotic humor and impish wiliness, the Kid was something of a bad boy or a bad good man character. At the same time, the darling of the common people, he had some of the good bad man quality of the American Robin Hood, similar to that of Jesse James," end quote. Belle Starr was one of the famous women of the West. She and her gang rode through Northwest Texas and Oklahoma and Texas panhandles with desperados and cutthroats that she dominated with, quote, "the force of her will and her proud, increasingly harsh personality. Her shrewdness and her astonishing literacy got her standing, if not as the leader of active operations, at least as the outfit's brains," end quote. The recorded interviews from Harold Priest and Sam Stewart provide two disparate pictures of Belle Starr. This is Harold Priest.
"Howdy, neighbors everywhere. I'm Harold Priest, and I'm from Bull Creek, which until just a few years ago was a pocket of the old West in the state of Texas, just west of Austin, my hometown. Some of my kin folks in Missouri were chased out of there by that she-wolf Belle Starr, who kind of butchered us up for our Union sympathies during the Civil War."
And here's Sam Stewart.
"Belle Starr, best friend I ever had in my life.
No kidding.
And the prettiest thing you ever looked at. Belle, her hair come along down here, just as black as a raven. Prettiest thing you ever looked at. Her cold black eyes. Last time I seen Belle, she's a scout from the Lord, so was I. We both going different directions."
In his review, Bruce Jackson noted that recordings of folk material are usually attempts to entertain or attempts to document, but rarely are they both. He believed that this album subordinates neither end. Any field recording can show us living folklore. This album helps show how and why some of it lived and survived. And in his final comments, reviewer Brummel called The Bad Men a brilliant exploitation of the enormous documentary potential of the photograph or phonograph. It can be called, and I do not use the word term lightly, an unqualified triumph of the recording art. Botkin's work focused on living lore and folk say. He often saw his work as documenting the transitions of folklore and culture, as both folklore and culture changed and became something new and old combined. With the Bad Men album revolving around a turntable, Botkin and his colleagues had a chance to make folklore living again. The album provides a legacy for Botkin, for his contemporaries in music, folklore, and history, and perhaps most interestingly, it creates a legacy for the enduring mix of myth and truth that personifies the early American West. Thank you. Oh, sure. Oh, I don't mean to jump into your thing here. What was the first clip? The first clip was a music one, right? Good shot. Okay.
Do you have a question, Bill, in the meantime?
I was sort of remarking, did you ever read any comments on why we had the pictures of all, they showed all the pictures of the artists, all the males were one size, but the one picture of, was it Bonnie Dobson? Carolyn Astro, you know, why she's double the size of everyone else.
Oh.
Huh. No, didn't see anything on that. It's actually pretty interesting because Botkin, like when we said in our introductions that he kept absolutely everything, this is probably one project where we have a lot, the least amount of stuff in regard to his usual habits. So a lot of the correspondence and some of the things, notes, drafts, and things that would maybe have some insight on that aren't around for this. But that doesn't mean it's not, it may not be in our repository, but it could be in other repositories. Okay, I think we can go ahead and try this again. Yeah.
By Billy Gashade.
I don't know. It may have been an itinerant singer or who may have said he wrote this version. Many times people say they wrote a folk song and it had both no validity. They were, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Many singers claim authorship of the song.
Yeah, it didn't come out very well. Any other?
Yes. Of the excerpts you've played, which ones were present on the original LP package? And I've got to follow up.
The Bold stuff is on there. But
what stuff?
The George Bold stuff is on there, but nothing else really.
Nothing else that we played was on there.
Okay, so then I take it, judging by the abstract that's in our program, that there you have a program to preserve and make all this accessible. Go into that, please.
Well, actually, if you were here at the workshop on Wednesday,
no.
Okay, all right. What we have gotten a grant from our library administration to digitally make these accessible digitally. So we've worked with the Marsound Archives in Kansas City to actually have them put onto CD-ROM and DVD, both as WAV files and then as the audio playback files. Then. From what I've learned on Wednesday, happily, is that because of the process that Mar goes through, that kind of gives new life to our open reel-to-reel tapes for a little while. So those will not go anywhere, but will be saved at that point. And so we have enough funds, I think, to do all the reel-to-reels that Botkin accumulated over time. That doesn't include any other of the discs that he made, which he has commercial recordings and some of his own audio recordings on. Now, I guess I'm not quite sure what, but from what I've learned, it's going to be a lacquer or aluminum disc or something like that that we haven't really investigated yet. Does that help? So in regard to what Mar Sound Archives is doing, I don't have specific details, but okay, right. So you will now have access because what will happen is that they are now going to be available in a digital format through the library. So you could come down and request them, and then we can get to them to you digitally. So yes, they are going to be accessible over time. Mm-hmm. That's a short answer then. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. Which are you putting up on the web?
I don't know. It's very interesting because in our institution is a little bit more careful about copyright issues. So depending on what happens with that, they would be made available just as snippets, but we certainly promote use as much as we can. So if they're not all completely there and you can make them usable in another mechanism, we would support that.